paired fathers in their 30s to those in their 20s, and the situation appears to be more drastic for fathers in later stages of life. Researchers have also hypothesized that autism is caused by mother-child genetic incompatibilities that play out during gestation. Others have proposed a theory of assortative mating, suggesting that people with particular personality types find one another more readily in our mobile, internet-enabled era, so that two people with mildly autistic tendencies, hypersystematizers, produce children together in whom those traits are concentrated. If we knew what goes on in the brain during autism, it would help establish which genes are implicated. If we knew which genes were implicated, we might be able to figure out what is happening in the brain. If we have only fragmentary knowledge of each thing, both goals are elusive. Up to 200 genes may be implicated in autism, and some evidence suggests that you need several to manifest the syndrome. Sometimes, epistatic or modifier genes influence the expression of primary genes. Sometimes, environmental factors influence the expression of these genes. The closer the relationship between genotype, what genes you have, and phenotype, what behavior or symptoms you manifest, the easier it is to discern. In autism, some people with a shared genotype don't share a phenotype, and some with a shared phenotype don't share a genotype. Genetic research has demonstrated variable penetrance in autism. That is, one can possess known risk genes and not be autistic. And conversely, one can be autistic without having any known risk genes. If one identical twin has autism, the chances are 60 to 90% that the other twin will be autistic as well, though the second twin may have a much milder or a much more severe version of autism. This indicates a strong genetic basis for the disorder. While traits such as eye color or Down syndrome are always shared by identical twins, many other characteristics are not shared absolutely, and the correlation for autism is the highest for any cognitive disorder, higher than for schizophrenia, depression, or obsessive-compulsive disorder. If one fraternal, non-identical twin has autism, the chances are 20 to 30% that the other twin will have autism. Fraternal twins do not have identical genetics, but they do have near-identical environments. Non-twin siblings of children with autism are some 20 times as likely to have the condition as members of the general population. Even unaffected close relatives of people with autism are likely to have some subclinical social difficulties. All this suggests that there are strong genetic factors in autism, but that genes alone do not explain all instances of the condition. A common disorder may be caused by a single anomalous gene. So anyone who has Huntington's disease, for example, has the aberrant Huntington's gene. Autism is the opposite of Huntington's in this regard. Hundreds of different genetic anomalies can predispose someone to autism. No individual rare gene variant occurs in very many people, but much of the population has a variant of some kind. The genome is full of hot spots, areas that mutate more easily and frequently than others. Some diseases, breast cancer for example, are linked to a small number of specific gene mutations, each of which occurs on a particular stretch of a particular chromosome, and they are easily traced because women who have them frequently reproduce. Autism genetics are harder to map because there seem to be many rare gene variants associated with autism that are not usually inherited. They are sprinkled all over the genome. As Matthew State, co-director of Yale's program on neurogenetics, has said, "Saying you have found an autism linkage peak on the part of the genome you are studying is like saying you live near Starbucks. Who doesn't live near Starbucks?" NIMH director Thomas Insull said, "It takes 5,000 genes to grow a normal brain, and conceptually, any of them could go wrong and cause autism. According to Michael Wigler at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, no single mutation is associated with more than 1% of instances of autism, and many of the genes implicated have yet to be discerned. It's not clear whether the complex symptoms of autism arise from a number of separate genetic effects, compromising language separately from social behaviors, for example, or whether one genetic effect, brought about by multiple genes, cascades to various brain regions to generate the characteristics of the syndrome. Most genes associated with autism are pleiotropic, which means that they have multiple effects. Some of these effects are linked with conditions that often co-occur with autism, such as ADHD, epilepsy, and gastrointestinal disorders. Most demonstrate small effect sizes, which means that a gene may boost your chance of developing autism by 10 or 20%, not boost it tenfold, as would happen for many disease risk alleles. Many genetic diseases occur because a particular gene is abnormal in its structure. In some others, however, a gene is missing entirely. In yet others, there are extra copies of a gene. So let's consider the sentence, "I am happy," as a stand-in for a sequence on the genome. The most frequent model for a disease would be for the sentence to come out as, "I am harpy," or "I ag happy," or some other such disruption. In a rare case, though, it might come out as, "I am happy," or alternatively as, "I am happy." Wigler and his colleague Jonathan Sabat have looked primarily at these copy number variations. A basic principle of genetics is that we have two of each gene, one from our mother and one from our father. But sometimes a person actually has 3, 4, or as many as 12 copies of a gene or group of genes, or in the case of deletions, only one copy of a gene or group of genes, or none at all. The average person has at least a dozen copy number variations, generally benign. Certain locations on the genome appear to be linked with cognitive disorders. Repetitions in these locations are associated with vulnerability to schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and autism. However, deletions in the same region are linked only to autism. Wigler has found that many of his autistic subjects possess large deletions, lacking as many as 27 genes. Sabat is now studying whether people with autism and a repetition have the same syndrome as those with autism and a deletion. He has found some significant correlations. For example, that the people with a deletion consistently have larger heads than those with a duplication in the same spot. The ultimate goal is to map these genes, describe their function, develop model systems, clarify molecular and cellular mechanisms, and then, finally, devise practical applications of findings. We are still identifying the rare variants. We are at the tip of the iceberg. Wigler pointed out that even when we've got all the information, we will have to contend with gene interactions that are not always subject to mathematical mapping. There is probably an interplay between personality and the deficit, he said. You and I could have similar deficiencies, but we would make different choices. It sounds odd that a 2-year-old may be making a choice about what he can and can't handle, but they probably do. You could have 2 kids that grow up in the same impoverished environment, and one joins the priesthood, and the other becomes a thief, right? I think that can happen internally. We are at the place now where we were 25 years ago with cancer genetics, said Daniel Geschwind, co-director of the Center for Neurobehavioral Genetics at UCLA. We know about 20% of the genetics. Given how late the work started compared with research on schizophrenia and depression, the progress is remarkable. Autism is a catch-all category for an unexplained constellation of symptoms. Whenever a subtype of autism with a specific mechanism is discovered, it ceases to be called autism and is assigned its own diagnostic name. Rett syndrome produces autistic symptoms. So, often, do phenylketonuria, PKU, tuberous sclerosis, neurofibromatosis, cortical dysplasia focal epilepsy, Timothy syndrome, Fragile X syndrome, and Joubert syndrome. People with these diagnoses are usually described as having autistic-type behaviors, but not autism per se. If autism is defined by behavior, however, it seems counterproductive to describe as not autistic those whose autistic behavior has a known origin. Until recently, researchers devoted limited energy to these infrequent syndromes, but some have now turned their attention to them with the thought that if we could understand why such conditions cause autistic behavior, we might be able to access the larger mechanisms of autism. Rapamycin, an immunosuppressant drug usually used in organ transplants, has suppressed seizures and reversed learning disabilities and memory problems in adult mice with tuberous sclerosis. It might have a similar effect on some human beings with the condition. Dr. Alcino Silva of UCLA said of that work, "Memory is as much about discarding trivial details as it is about storing useful information. Our findings suggest that mice with the mutation cannot distinguish between important and unimportant data. We suspect that their brains are filled with meaningless noise that interferes with learning." This evokes the sensory experience described by many autistic people. Noise may be a major mechanism of the syndrome. Fragile X and Rett syndrome are both single-gene mutations. People with Fragile X have a gene mutation that encodes a protein that in turn blocks an important brake on protein synthesis in the brain. While the mechanism by which the mutation causes intellectual and behavioral deficits is not known, a current theory is that these symptoms result from excessive protein production. Mice artificially bred with a Fragile X mutation overproduce protein and show learning problems and social deficits. One therapy for Fragile X syndrome would be to block the mGluR5 receptor, which is a major stimulus for protein synthesis in the brain. Drugs that do so have reduced the excessive protein, suppressed seizures, and normalized behavior in Fragile X mice. The genetics and mechanism of Rett syndrome differ from those associated with Fragile X, but mice artificially bred with the Rett syndrome mutation have likewise responded to drugs that target a pathway affected by their mutation. A surprising finding from studies of mice with either Fragile X or Rett syndrome is that even adult mice have shown striking reversal of symptoms with medication. Drugs for Fragile X and Rett syndrome are now in early-stage clinical trials in humans, and very preliminary data with at least one compound suggest positive effects on social engagement in children with Fragile X. Recent biomedical research has been fraught with exciting findings in mice that cannot be replicated in humans. Nonetheless, these findings raise a significant challenge to the assumption that developmental disorders are hardwired into the brain and cannot be reversed. If they are a consequence of impaired function of cellular pathways, then it may be possible to resolve some symptoms of autism without altering genes. In other words, autism symptoms may reflect not brain development, which is usually irreversible, but brain function, which is often pliable. It is clear, however, that instigating normal brain function in someone whose brain has developed without it will not fully resolve symptoms. Geraldine Dawson, chief science officer of Autism Speaks, said, "You fix their car's broken engine, but you still have to teach them to drive." In 2012, Wigler and other scientists at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory discovered a link between genes affected by Fragile X and genes that are disrupted in some children with idiopathic autism. This suggests that medications showing promise in Fragile X may be helpful to a larger subset of autistic people. Wigler and Sabat believe that we'll eventually see what more of the rare gene variants do. Some probably disable or duplicate enzymes that a drug might mimic or inhibit. Others might affect neurotransmitter levels or change the pH or environment of the synapse, and it may be possible to reverse those effects. I would be amazed if there aren't pharmacological treatments for more of this, Wigler said. We'll never know all the genes, and we'll never have a treatment that works for everyone, but we should be able to find good treatments for a subset of patients. The Cambridge autism researcher Simon Baron-Cohen postulates that women are empathizers, hardwired to understand others, while men are systematizers, hardwired to organize factual and mechanical information. Autism, in this view, is an overexpression of cognitive masculinity, short on empathy and long on systems. Baron-Cohen has investigated the extent to which unusually high levels of prenatal testosterone might alter brain structure and engender autism. Given that more androgens circulate in utero during pregnancy with a boy, a smaller excess would tip a male fetus into autism than would tip a female. This may be a partial explanation for why autism occurs twice as often in males as in females. Autistic people are indeed often systematizers. Many have uncanny technical abilities. Some are savants who do not function independently in many areas of life, but have extraordinary abilities in one domain. Sometimes a relatively trivial one, such as the ability immediately to list the dates of Easter for every year until the end of time, and sometimes a useful one, such as the competence to create meticulously accurate drawings, or to hold in mind a complex design, or to produce a perfect map of Rome after flying over the city once. Whether this has to do with prenatal testosterone is subject to debate, but there is a maleness to this way of being. Extreme trauma can provoke behavior that resembles autism. Some people appear autistic following perinatal injury. Grossly neglected children taken from Ceausescu-era Romanian orphanages often showed autistic-like behavior, though examination showed them disengaged, not merely from other people, but also from the material world. Bruno Bettelheim was a Holocaust survivor who had seen autistic-style withdrawal in other inmates at Dachau, and on this basis, he mistakenly concluded that all autism was linked to abuse. Certainly, however, abuse can exacerbate symptoms associated with the disorder. Too often, the presence of autism confuses parents and doctors so that other ailments may go undetected or untreated. Margaret Bauman of Harvard Medical School described how one of her autistic patients had for years suffered spasmodic twists and writhing. These had been presumed to be symptoms of autism and therefore ran unchecked. Referral to a gastroenterologist revealed that the patient had esophageal ulcers. When these were treated, her gyrations stopped. Fred Volkmar at Yale described a 9-year-old boy who had such severe motor issues that he was unable to hold a pencil. When the boy entered third grade and the other students were learning cursive penmanship, Volkmar suggested giving the boy a laptop. The teacher objected to giving the boy a crutch, Volkmar said. If you didn't have a leg and I gave you a crutch, that would be a mitzvah. Approximately 1/3 of autistic people have at least one psychiatric diagnosis in addition to autism, compared to 10% of the general population. But they frequently don't get treatment for these complicating factors. 1 in 5 suffers from clinical depression, and about 18% from anxiety. Kamran Nazir's autistic friend Elizabeth had inherited a tendency toward depression from her non-autistic parents. The doctors were reluctant to prescribe antidepressants or make any firm diagnosis of the malaise, he writes mournfully. Wasn't it all really caused by her autism? She eventually committed suicide. John Chestak and Portia Iverson founded Cure Autism Now, which was the leading private funder of autism research until it merged with Autism Speaks. They started the Autism Genetic Research Exchange, the largest open resource gene bank in the world. They drafted many leading autism geneticists. The belief that poor parenting caused autism meant that no meaningful research was done for 50 years after it was described, Portia said. When our son, Dov, was diagnosed, autism was under the radar, not under the microscope. I didn't think I was good at science, but the same way you learn to jump if your house is on fire and you're on the third floor, that's how I learned the science of autism. She wanted to increase researchers' contact with families affected by autism. The most effective thing we could do was to become the data, she said. Like Carly Fleischman, Dov Chestak has emerged as having normal intelligence, a whole mind that had been immured in silence for many years. When he was 9, Portia asked him to point to the letter S, and he did so, and she soon realized that he could read. It was really shocking, she said. You don't think they can read when you don't know they can think. When she understood that Dov could express himself, she asked him what he'd been doing all these years. Listening, he said. His education remains problematic. He needs one-on-one support, but he's cognitively normal. There's a popular belief that you can't have someone who acts retarded and is intelligent, Portia said. But you can. Portia Iverson has investigated the deepest riddle of autism, the relationship between what can be observed and what is going on inside autistic people. Some autistic people seem unmotivated to communicate. I can't be positive, but it appears that way. Then there are people who desperately want to be understood. I see a big split in my son between his disorder and his personality. He's mostly not doing what he wants to do and acting as he wants to act. Many mornings, he starts making whining noises, flipping his hands. It's like a chemical storm. It just drives him. Even with that, he's much happier than before I realized he was saying something. Even constrained communication is the difference between life and death. Given the broad range of symptoms, all of which seldom coincide in a single case, diagnosis is an extremely subtle enterprise and is made more difficult by the idea of an autism spectrum that fades into normality at one end. It's much like IQ, weight, or height, Geschwin points out. There's optimal weight, there's a few extra pounds that some people may find unattractive, there's obesity that undermines everything else about your health. Everyone's mind is disordered in some measure sometimes. And how a spectrum contiguous with normality can also be categorical is a complicated question. Classrooms, Isabel Rapin said, are dichotomous, which is the only reason for these classifications of children whose differences are not black and white, so they can be put in the right room or center. This is policy, not biology. The innumerable questionnaires and inventories seldom fully sufficient for diagnosis, include the Autism Behavior Checklist, ABC, the Childhood Autism Rating Scale, CARS, the popular Checklist for Autism in Toddlers, CHAT, the 7-hour-long Diagnostic Interview for Social and Communication Disorders, DISCO, the Autism Diagnostic Interview Revised, ADIR, and the highly regarded Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale, generic ADOS-G. It's hard to find a consistent instrument that applies to both people who speak and those who are nonverbal. Any of these tests can produce different results, depending on who is conducting it. In the ADOS, for example, you are supposed to see if you can coax a child into imaginative play. Some examiners I observed had tremendous vitality and imagination. Others were simpering or overbearing or tired and not imaginative themselves. Also, the examiner has to be able to distinguish between what the child can't do, autism, and what they won't do, personality or mood issues. The severity of autistic symptoms tends to fluctuate in any individual, so someone may perform differently one day from another. More adults are seeking diagnosis, so the tests have to work for people of variable ages. Because autism is a developmental disorder, however, it is not diagnosed unless symptoms began before age 3. Autistic-like symptoms that set in later are not considered developmental. Medicine has been too eager in many cases to dismiss parents' insight. August Beer, a physician practicing in the early 20th century, said, "A smart mother often makes a better diagnosis than a poor doctor." The closeness with which a parent observes can be as powerful as the expertise with which a physician observes, and setting them up in opposition to each other is a disaster for everyone. But medicine is often unprepared for parental perspectives that do not align with an illness model. For many parents, diagnosis is a crossing of the Styx into hell. For others, such as Kathleen Seidel, disability rights advocate, founder of the website neurodiversity.com, and parent of a young adult diagnosed with Asperger syndrome at the age of 10, it can be a revelation. "I think of diagnoses as an aid to pattern recognition in our lives," she said. "We could make sense out of things that had previously been inexplicable to us. We felt validated. At the same time, I could feel this pull of lessened expectations by virtue of a diagnosis, and it didn't seem right or healthy to me to think that way. God has many different ways to build a brain." A Cray supercomputer is used for really complex, intense computing that involves the manipulation of massive amounts of data. It runs so hot, it has to be kept in a liquid cooling bath. It requires a very special kind of TLC. And is the Cray defective because it requires this kind of nurturing environment for its functioning? No, it kicks ass. That's what my kid is like. He needs support, needs attention, and is amazing. Marvin Brown's mother, Isilda, has delineated what she can influence and what she cannot, and she does not rail against what is beyond amelioration. It is easy to patronize simple wisdom by honeying the rough circumstances from which it generally springs, or by representing it as simpler or wiser than it is. But Isilda Brown seemed more at peace with her son's condition than almost any other mother I met. A lifetime of non-choices had given her a gift for acceptance. She demanded good services for her son, but did not expect those services to turn him into someone else. The story of middle-class and affluent parenting of autistic children is an interminable saga of tilting at windmills. In contrast, I admired both Isilda's acquiescence and the happiness that was its corollary. Isilda grew up in South Carolina, one of 10 children in a poor African-American farming family. She came to New York in the 1960s and found work cleaning houses. She married young, and by 30 she was mother to 5 children. Marvin was next to youngest. By 2, Isilda said, he was different. 3 years old, he started to talk, and then he just stopped. And he didn't really try to talk anymore until he was 5. The diagnosis of autism came when he was almost 4 in 1976. "He never would cry," Isilda recalled. "He just would be happy, playing and running back and forth. He would get up early, 2 in the morning every day. When he gets up, I get up. He couldn't stay still. I just got used to it." Cleaning houses for a living is not light work, and Isilda did it for many years on the 3 to 4 hours of sleep that her life with Marvin allowed her. "I prayed not to be too tired," she said. "I prayed for guidance to help me do the right thing and for strength to put up with him, because that's what it takes every day. Isilda enrolled Marvin in a program for autistic children at Jacoby Hospital in the North Bronx, an hour from her home. The program kids were mostly attending public schools near Jacoby, and since Marvin hated to travel, Isilda picked up her family and moved near the schools. Marvin was a hand flapper and had many other repetitive behaviors. He had limited speech. Even though Isilda's husband left when Marvin was 10, he has had a constant, attentive mother, the same schools, the same apartment, as much continuity as Isilda was able to manage. "When he's sad, he'll tell you, 'I'm very sad,' Isilda said. 'When he's happy, he's happy. If he gets angry, he'll say, "I'm angry." And I'll talk him down and pat him. I'll say, "You just sit down and relax." I can calm him." As a devout Jehovah's Witness, Isilda has relied on the community of her religion. "Our church was the biggest comfort and still is. Everyone there was very, very supportive. All of them know him. He knows them." Taking care of Marvin became easier in some ways as he grew older. He slept more. He was better able to be on his own. But he became more self-conscious about his condition. When Marvin entered his 20s, Isilda gave up cleaning houses and found work taking care of the elderly in Mount Vernon, New York, and her hours were a bit lighter. She had been advised by professionals that Marvin might do well in a group home, and she secured a place for him. Before taking him there, she said, "This is only if you want to stay." She promised to bring him home every weekend. At first, he said he didn't like it, but she insisted that he give it a fair chance. He was no happier at the end of the year, so she brought him home. Some 5 years later, while Marvin was attending a day program in the Bronx, he became upset. Others who were present later claimed that he was provoked by one of his teachers. Although Marvin had no history of violence, the day program worker called the police, who manacled him and brought him to a mental hospital. When Isilda learned that her son was locked up, she rushed to the hospital to retrieve him. Marvin was terrified and utterly confused. Isilda was outraged. "I sent a letter to the mayor, the commissioner, everybody. I got one of the people I used to clean for to help me write. They brought the whole state down on them. They put the program under investigation." Other frightened people had gone through the same experience, and the woman who was responsible was removed from her job. Isilda transferred Marvin to a new day program, where he has been prepared for employment. Under supervision, he has worked in a bookstore and for a messenger service, and has learned to perform janitorial duties. Isilda was 62 when we met, and it had been 43 years since she began the care of infants. "He takes a lot of supervision," she said, "but he calls me, you know, my friend." She said it with domestic bluster and contentment and a shy smile. Isilda has become a community resource. She has met with hundreds of other parents, and she made videos of Marvin that are shown at the centers where he has been helped. I'll say, "You see my son now, and now you see your kids running and not talking. That was him. If you give up, your child doesn't have a chance." She paused with a big, open smile. I looked back, and I said to the Lord, "Oh, thank you for bringing me from such a long ways." The Autism Society of America estimates that 1.5 million Americans are on the spectrum. The CDC says 560,000 people under 21 have autism. The U.S. Department of Education says that autism is growing at a rate of 10 to 17% per year, and that numbers in the United States could reach 4 million in the next decade. Recent work suggests that more than 1% of the world population may be on the spectrum. part of the upsurge has to do with the broadening of categories. People who might once have been classed as schizotypal or mentally retarded are now on the spectrum, as are some who would once have been thought odd but not given a diagnosis. Aggressive advocacy by parents has helped to establish better services for kids with autism than for kids with other afflictions. If you attach better services to a diagnostic category, some doctors will apply that diagnosis to children for whom it is not entirely appropriate in order to access those services. Parents who might once have shunned an autism label to avoid being unjustly blamed for their child's disability are now willing to seek out that label so their children may qualify for special education services. California, for example, has considerable diagnostic substitution. The state reported a decrease in mental retardation coincident with a 12-fold increase over 20 years in services for autism. Autism researcher Laura Schreibman estimates that the lifetime cost of autism is $5 million. Even parents with full insurance incur tremendous annual costs. Many insurers refuse to pay for labor-intensive strategies such as ABA, which is an educational rather than a medical strategy. And many parents who have the wherewithal sue their insurance company, their school board, their local government, or all three. Having a severely impaired child is utterly draining. These legal proceedings often stretch parents to the breaking point. Is autism itself also on the rise? Inconceivable time and energy have been poured into this question, and no consensus has emerged, but it seems reasonable to conclude that both diagnosis and incidence have increased. During the decade that I spent working on this book, people would hear my list of chapters and then offer to introduce me to friends who were dealing with autism at least 10 times as often as they would offer introductions to people with any of the other conditions. NIMH Director Thomas Insull recounted a time during the 1970s when an autistic child was admitted to Boston Children's Hospital. The chief of service called the residents together to observe him, reasoning that they might never see an autistic child again. On Insull's own street today, which has 9 houses, 2 children have autism. Stephen Hyman, former head of the NIMH and former provost of Harvard, said, "The growth in the diagnosis of the autism spectrum reflects destigmatization and broader education. Does that mean that there is no increase in incidence? No, but it confounds our ability to tell." Several studies applying current diagnostic criteria have shown that people who were once considered non-autistic would be considered autistic by current criteria, though such work is always somewhat speculative. Many scientists have argued that regressive autism is not regressive at all, that children with a particular genotype simply begin to show symptoms at a stage in their development. The autism comes at its time, like teeth or body hair. Many parents whose children have regressed, however, argue nearly the opposite, that regression is caused by a specific environmental trigger. Because regression often occurs at around the same age that children are immunized, many parents have attributed their children's autism to vaccines, particularly the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and vaccines containing the mercury-based preservative thimerosal. MMR was introduced in the United States in the 1970s, and by the 1980s was in widespread use. Because it is not effective during the first year of life, when maternal antibodies block its action, the first dose is administered at about 13 months. In 1998, British gastroenterologist Andrew Wakefield of the Royal Free Hospital published a paper in The Lancet, positing an association between the MMR vaccine and gastrointestinal problems in autistic children. Wakefield and his colleagues described only 12 cases. Nonetheless, journalists seized upon the story, and many parents stopped vaccinating their children. In Britain, rates of immunization against measles dropped from 92% to less than 80%, and cases of the disease began to skyrocket. Whereas only 56 children in England and Wales contracted measles in 1998, and none died, in 2008, 5,088 cases were reported in the UK, resulting in the deaths of two children. Numerous demographic studies have consistently failed to demonstrate a link between vaccines and autism. One study conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention followed 140,000 children and showed no connection. A Japanese study demonstrated that unvaccinated children actually had a higher rate of autism. After it became known that Wakefield was recruited by an attorney seeking to build a legal case against vaccine manufacturers, that 11 of the 12 study subjects were involved in this litigation, and that Wakefield had been paid for his services by the UK Legal Aid Corporation, 10 of the study's 13 authors officially retracted their names from it. The Lancet's editor subsequently apologized for publishing the paper, which he described as fatally flawed. In 2010, following an investigation by the UK General Medical Council, the journal retracted it altogether. With the advent of each new piece of evidence absolving vaccines, Wakefield's acolytes have alleged a cover-up and have shifted to new arguments that keep vaccines in the spotlight. Once thimerosal had been removed from all vaccines routinely administered to children without any decrease in the rate of autism diagnoses, some proposed that the problem arose from combination vaccines and their supposed assault on the immune system, or simply from too many vaccinations altogether. Witnessing autistic regression seems to traumatize parents much more deeply than recognizing a disorder present from birth. Parents are possessed by the idea that the child who once played and laughed with them can be rediscovered. Most of our understanding of autistic regression comes from speaking to parents about their children's development. Typically, parents of children who regress witness their child's loss of language at about 16 months. I met one child who was evaluated because he had an autistic brother and was therefore considered high risk. At 6 months, he was chortling, playing, and enjoying his exchange with a diagnostician. At a little more than a year, the same child appeared oblivious to the same evaluator. He did not laugh, smile, or acknowledge the presence of others. He seemed flabby and glassy-eyed. It was difficult to believe that he was the same child. Some researchers have questioned whether such regression results from loss of function, or whether apparent early sociability in infancy may rely on different brain regions than more mature sociability. Researchers have estimated that between 20 and 50% of autism cases involve regression. The journalist David Kirby's Evidence of Harm describes the evolution of the autism vaccine hypothesis and reports on the divisions between parents convinced that vaccines harm their children and scientists and policymakers involved in vaccine development. Each side believes that the other is motivated by financial conflicts of interest and willfully distorted science. Citing failure of petitioners' attorneys to produce adequate scientific support for their causation arguments, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is currently in the process of dismissing over 5,000 claims alleging that vaccines are responsible for making children autistic. The debate is frequently acrimonious. Katie Wright, daughter of Autism Speaks co-founders Bob and Suzanne Wright, has claimed that her son began to display signs of autism immediately after being vaccinated, and that he has recovered in part through treatments that address the vaccine injury. She has urged her parents and the scientists they support to abandon failed strategies and embrace her perspective. The Wrights posted a statement on the Autism Speaks website clarifying that their daughter's personal views differ from ours. The vaccine argument is championed by ex-Playboy centerfold and comedian Jenny McCarthy. Critics have observed that McCarthy gains considerable publicity from her crusade and earns a tidy living from speaking engagements. In March 2008, the Atlanta Court of Federal Claims conceded in the Hanna Poling case that a chickenpox vaccine had probably aggravated an underlying mitochondrial disorder to create autistic-type symptoms in one child. The case has been treated by anti-vaccinationists as overdue justice. Some draw parallels between themselves and the early anti-tobacco movement. We had an epidemic in lung cancer and heart disease in the 50s and 60s, and the cigarette companies had all this science that showed cigarettes had nothing to do with it, said Lenny Schaefer, progenitor of the Schaefer Autism Report, and adoptive father of a young man with autism. Many neurodiversity and autism rights activists are, conversely, offended by the vaccine arguments, which they find scientifically groundless and insulting to people with autism. Kathleen Seidel said, "Juries and judges hear these stories, and people's hearts lead the way. But hearts leading the way don't always lead to justice." Epidemiological studies have demonstrated no correlation between vaccination and autism. Does that mean that no children have a vulnerability triggered by vaccines? One mother whose child regressed told me, "The pediatrician gave him the vaccine, and within 24 hours, he had a white count of 31,000. He was in the hospital, and they said it was sepsis. After he came out, he was less socially engaged. A lot less socially engaged. It was like I went into the hospital with one kid, and I came out with another." Portia Iverson said, "You can't confront someone's experience with a lot of evidence." Insel said, "It seems to me that the story is the increase in food allergies, asthma, diabetes, autism, pediatric bipolar disorder, which has gone up 40-fold in the last 10 years. I wonder if there isn't something more general going on that explains all of this. I can't tell you what, but that sounds to me like an environmental factor." Unfortunately, modern life has too many environmental variables to catalog. Cell phones, air travel, televisions, vitamin pills, food additives. Many people believe that environmental heavy metals have afflicted their children. Others blame a broad range of other substances, especially bisphenol A, a man-made estrogen-based polymer used in plastics, which has an annual production of more than 3 million tons. Most geneticists acknowledge that these questions have not been fully resolved, and that they may not be resolved for many years. Reversing much-accepted science, however, in 2011, Stanford psychiatrist Joachim Hallmeier and his colleagues checked identical and fraternal twins for autism and used mathematical modeling to show that genetics determined only 38% of the cases they studied, while shared environmental factors appeared to be primarily responsible in 58% of cases. The rate of concordance in identical twins was lower than anticipated, suggesting that genetics does not tell the whole story. The rate of concordance in fraternal twins was higher than expected, suggesting that environment, perhaps the uterine environment, plays a significant role. Neil Risch, the director of the UCSF Institute for Human Genetics and the designer of the study, said, "We're not trying to say there isn't a genetic component, quite the opposite. But for most individuals with autism spectrum disorder, it's not simply a genetic cause." The study was described as a game changer by Joseph Coyle, editor of Archives of General Psychiatry. A separate group, in a study published at the same time and in the same journal, found that mothers who took SSRIs, a category of antidepressants, just before or during pregnancy, had children with an increased risk of autism. These data are all preliminary, and the data showing that autism is 70% heritable are more robust. But mainstream science will have to reconsider the idea of significant environmental risk. Mark Blaxall is a polished Princeton graduate, founder of a business consulting firm, and one of the most sophisticated proponents of the vaccine causation of autism. He and his wife Elise went through 10 rounds of IVF, 10 miscarriages, and 2 ectopic pregnancies. They finally produced 2 daughters. Their second, Michaela, seemed to develop normally for her first year. But before she turned 2, Elise began to think something was wrong. When she was 2 years and 9 months, they got a diagnosis. "I wasn't engaged," Mark said. "Work was a big deal. Michaela was an easy child. My way of dealing with the grief was to get really aggressive about learning everything I could, so I went almost to vocational school in neuroscience. I was consumed with it." By the time I met Mark, Michaela was 12 and had made significant progress. Mark listed the 10 people who took care of her. Therapists, sitters, doctors who attended to her delicate physical health. He was well aware that few people could afford all this. Nonetheless, he was deeply frustrated. Michaela had a full syndrome autistic diagnosis when she started. She didn't speak. Now she's engaged, lovely, very social. The language is still not quite at an Asperger's level, but she's approaching that. But all she wants to talk about is Jiminy Cricket and Pinocchio. Our job is to move her off that. I just want her to talk about something other than Jiminy Cricket. Mark is consumed with his activism. "I think autism is a brain rash," he said to me. "And if you have politically incorrect ideas, like the fact that autism originated in vaccines and mercury, then you get accused of obstructing scientific inquiry. We believe that it's the epidemic, stupid. It's environmental. I'm unsatisfied with the solutions. I'm unsatisfied with the science. I'm unsatisfied with the institutions. Genetics research has failed miserably. And the CDC's job is to manage vaccine safety. So they produce bullshit studies that give them the outcome they want." Mark talked about a study he co-authored that showed reduced mercury levels in the first haircuts of autistic children, which he took as evidence that they are not able to excrete mercury as effectively as other babies. He has published peer-reviewed papers in respected journals such as Neurotoxicology. Encountering his passion, it's hard not to be converted, except that much of the science he cites has been soundly refuted, and much of the science he disparages appears to have a strong empirical basis. Of course, science is always subject to revision, but as Bruce Stillman, president of Cold Spring Harbor Lab, has pointed out, science cannot have an agenda, and it appears that this science does. Mark said, "I was the captain of the football team, the president of the student council, national merit scholar. I was a pleasure for my parents to have as a child. The autism advocacy thing is about the mission. It's not about winning or making more money than the other guy or getting better grades. You can sign yourself to the margin of respectable society if you do what I've chosen to do. It's liberating. 'Cause I don't give a shit what the New York Times thinks. I just want to do the right thing and make a mark on the world." American law provides guarantees of education that are not matched by guarantees of medical care. Education is a government responsibility. Medical care is a personal responsibility, controlled in large measure by insurance companies. For that reason, some advocates have preferred to keep treatment for autism in the arena of education rather than of medicine. So far, the pedagogic interventions appear to work better than the medical ones, so most current treatments are school-based. As with Down syndrome and many other disabilities, autism is best identified and addressed as early as possible. Early intervention requires early detection. Amy Klin and colleagues at Yale have conducted an experiment in which both autistic and non-autistic adults watched Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Using computer tracking, the researchers found that autistic people do not switch their gaze back and forth between the arguing protagonists, as non-autistic subjects do. Building on that work, they have infants watch videos of other children and mothers. The typically developing infants focus on eyes, while the ones at risk for autism focus on objects or mouths. Despite broad concurrence that early diagnosis is valuable because early treatment is effective, there is no consensus about what that early treatment should be. As Brynna Siegel, a psychologist at UCSF, has written in Helping Children with Autism Learn, the picture of autism treatment is complicated by the fact that there are very different perspectives from which to view treatment: developmental, behavioral, educational, cognitive, and medical. Practitioners from these different perspectives often don't understand one another's vocabularies. Charles Furster, an American behavioral psychologist, was the first to propose that people could learn through conditioning just as animals do. This idea led in the 1960s to the behavioral interventions now used in treating autism, most particularly to applied behavior analysis, ABA. Such treatments are based on observing the child, pinpointing his negative or obsessive behaviors, and developing positive substitutes for them. Desirable acts receive positive reinforcement. If the child speaks, for example, he may get what he wants. Negative acts do not receive reinforcement. Temper tantrums are never rewarded. Many behaviorist treatments are in circulation. Much of this teaching remains unnatural to the child and thus requires constant maintenance. Yet many parents consider it vital, just as many hearing parents require a language in which they can communicate with their deaf children. Other successful autism treatments involve learning from behavior of the person with autism. Dr. Stanley Greenspan garnered an enormous amount of publicity for his developmental, individual difference, relationship-based, DIR floor time, model, which involves getting down on the floor with the autistic child to forge a connection. Auditory integration training and sensory integration therapy attempt to address the particular hypersensitivities of autistic children. Speech therapy introduces them to the use of language and helps with articulation. Soma Mukhopadhyay, with no background in the field, developed the Rapid Prompting Method, RPM, in India to treat her own son, who is nonverbal and now types poetry. Service dogs that resemble seeing eye dogs are often invaluable to autistic children and adults, helping to stave off panic attacks, provide physical orientation, and build an emotional bridge between autistic people and the social world. One mother exulted about the change in her son, Caleb, after a service dog joined their family. "He seems so much more secure and more grounded than he ever has before. He seems to be handling things so much better. It's so important for Caleb and Chewy to be together 24 hours a day. They both need to know that they are each other's constant." A legal brief about whether Caleb should be allowed to take a dog to school said, "Since receiving Chewy, Caleb becomes upset for shorter periods of time, completes his homework, and sleeps between 6 to 8 hours per night. He has less difficulty transitioning between home and other public places, including school." Some parents modify their children's diets, as there are anecdotes of people with autism who are unable to tolerate gluten, casein, and other substances that occur in many foods. The SSRIs, the The class of antidepressants that includes Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil have been used to control the anxiety to which some autistic people are subject. The results appear to be mixed.